Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 7th of Iyar. Today we're going to see Rav Kook's discussion about what we can avoid, what we can't avoid. There's a specific question that came up for him, which is about a soldier who didn't have a chance to mourn for his father. But the discussion as a whole is really going to be about the question of how we assign or don't assign culpability, liability, or responsibility, maybe the best word, for that which is not fully within our control or that we didn't fully intend. This is from Dat Kohen in Yanei Yerodea, Matters of Yerodea, Simon Resh Taf Zayin, response number 116. We should remember to thank the OU, especially Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hachhauser, for giving us the opportunity to share these shiurim with you online. This is from the 7th of Iyar of Tuf Resh Ayin Vav of 1916 in London. Remember that Rav Kook got caught in London for much of World War I, and I think he became a rav of a shul there, and he became known because he's Rav Kook, so he became known there as well. So he is writing this letter to a man named Rabbi Mendel Yitzchok Berman, who is in fact also was an important rav who had been from Europe and had made his way to England before the war, and he is part of the Berman family, which it turns out is like an important family there. If I found the website, kehillalinks.jewishgen.org. If you look up Mendel Berman, Behrman, there's the Bear family tree, Behr, because there's a man named Bear Drucker who came to Krottingen in Lithuania from Danzig in 1723, and then there's this whole Bear family, and this Rabbi Mendel Berman, who was a recognized and important Talmud Chacham, Torah scholar, came to England and became the rabbi in Middlesbrough, and he was rabbi somewhere else first, and then he was rabbi in Middlesbrough. That's where he's writing Rav Kook from, and he lives in London the rest of his life in England, the rest of his life, until he passes away. So his question was, and the Rav Kook compliments the question in the way that rabbis do. He says, she'ilat chacham, it is the question of an intelligent, a wise man, shehi tshuva shlema. Part of the compliments you give to a question is that the person asking the question is given much of the answer already. The point being to sort of say, it's nice of you to ask me, but you clearly are on top of these issues as well, and you've gotten much, if not all, of what you needed to know. So it's about a man who's in the army. I assume it's a Jewish man from Great Britain who is in the British Army during World War I, and he's there on the battlefield, and he's busy with ammunition. He was in HaTotach, so I think he was in the cannon, brigade, and he's busy with doing that, and he gets a shmua krova miftirat aviv. So we're in the 7th of Iyar now. So in the tshuva, I meant. That's when the question is being asked. So let's remember that when it comes to halachot of avelut, of mourning, there is a distinction in halacha between what's called a shmua rechoka and a shmua krova. Nowadays, we don't imagine such things happening so much anymore, but certainly before you had instantaneous communications of various sorts, before you had telegraph, right? Even just go back that far, which is 200 years ago, you didn't really have telegraphs, you didn't have telephones, you didn't have this, you didn't have that. So it was easily possible, and therefore the Gemara discusses it, that somebody would live in a place where they wouldn't hear about the passing of a close relative until more than 30 days afterwards. Today, I think it mostly comes up in the context of when you have elderly relatives who are ill or just frail, and so sometimes people worry about how they'll handle the news, and you can imagine people withholding the news until it becomes what's called a shmua rechoka. After 30 days, but it originally came up in the context of just the news didn't get there, and you were trying to get it there just then, if in the year 1000, in Rashi's time, that's slightly before Rashi's time, you have somebody living in France and a relative passes away in Spain, however that would happen, it's at least plausible the news wouldn't get there until after 30 days. Once 30 days has passed, it's called a Shmua Rechoka. When it's a Shmua Rechoka, the only obligation is to do, instead of Shiva, you would do one act of avilut. Like you'd sit on the ground, you'd remove your shoes, and that would be enough to qualify as the avilut you needed to do. But this man got a shwa kirova. He got the news within 30 days. You get the news within 30 days, so then even though it's not the actual shiva, you could easily imagine you'd have a group of relatives who've already sat shiva for this person. 2 weeks later, another relative hears that relative has to sit shiva, a full shiva, even though the relative is now, the person who passed away, the niftar, has passed away 3 weeks ago and was buried 3 weeks ago, and there was a shiva already observed. It doesn't matter. There's also a personal element of having to sit shiva, and that comes up within within 30 days. So he hears within 30 days, lifnei cholamoid Pesach ha'avar, before the previous, or Chag Pesach ha'avar, before the previous Pesach is when he heard. Now the reason why that's important is that theoretically, the coming of a holiday stops avilut, because on a holiday one is required to be in a state of simcha, and therefore it stops. So that's why if people are sitting Shiva, sadly, and a holiday happens, or Hashanah, Yom Kippur, or Pesach, Shavuos, then that stops Shiva, and then they start their Shloshim count. If they're already in Shloshim, meaning they've already sat a full Shiva, and they've sit Shloshim, even if their Shiva ends Erev Yom Tov, so they haven't really had much Shloshim, they had only a little bit of Shloshim, it will end Shloshim. So that's why they mention the Chag HaPesach Shloshim, but he hasn't observed anything. So, statement in the question is, who may own solo kiyei mitzvat avilut, because he's at war, and therefore he's part of the army, and he has to do what's done in the army, he didn't fulfill the obligation of avilut, and he also didn't know that he was obligated to keep avilut, even though he's in the army. He didn't realize, right, a lot of people don't know halacha so well, but when he got the news, he did cry, and he did get upset about it. And he was mikonein. So mikonein, I don't think it means formally he like sat down and wrote a poem of an elegy, but it means he spoke to friends about it. He said how terrible it was, how sad he was that his father had passed away. And now the holiday is over, and he realizes he's got some time. Let's say he comes to ask a question, right? But now that the holiday is over, it's also more than 30 days after the passing. Rak petoch lamid lashmua. So, person passed away, he heard a shmua krova, he heard the shmua before 30 days had passed. Now that he's coming to ask the question, more than 30 days have passed since he heard, I'm sorry, more than 30 days have passed since the person passed away, so he's not in shmua krova territory for that, but it's within 30 days of when he heard. So the question is, does he now have to sit shiva? Such as, where would be an example of that? Kidin, Misha Shagag o Hizid o Lohayalo Shehut Kodem HaRegel. When there are people who hear about an Avelut that they are required to observe, and they hear about it before a holiday, let's say before Pesach, and then for whatever reason they don't keep Shiva. They don't keep any Avelus. We'll get to how much Avelus you have to keep in a second, but they don't keep any Avelus. So that could be because they had really no time, such as a person, let's say, who was in jail and didn't get out in time or didn't know what they could do, or they were ill and they couldn't in any way observe the Shiva, or they just didn't realize they were required to, right? Let's say they didn't know there was halacha of Shmua Krova, so they hear your relatives already finished Shiva, and they hear about this, you know, 3 days before Pesach, Shmua Krova, but they hear about it 3 days before, so they don't realize that there's such a thing as they should still sit Shiva, even though they would think maybe, oh, if they already did it, then I'm out of it, and there's nothing I can do. So that would be an example of a shogeg, somebody who doesn't realize they were supposed to sit Shiva, or hizid, or they said, listen, I'm busy, I'm getting ready for the Chag, I can't take care of this now, I'll have to do it another time. They just didn't do it. So in all those situations, in all those cases, Shulchan Aruch in Yeridah, Shin Tzadi Tet, Aleph says that the coming of Pesach will not removed from them the obligation of Shiva. They have an obligation of Shiva. They're going to have to sit Shiva, not on HaPesach, not on a holiday, but after the holiday they will. That would be true for all those possibilities. Shogeg, remember the possibilities are, they were too busy, which would, you know, they didn't have a Shehut, how you'd categorize that we'll talk about, we could think about. Hazid, on purpose, or Shogeg. But if a person was an Ones, so maybe some of the examples I gave might qualify as Ones. If they were too sick, might be an Ones. If they were in jail, it might be an Ones, but we could think about that when we get to the examples of Ones. So that would be different. So if we accept that it was an Ones, that he was really against his will, that it was something he could do about it to be able to sit Shiva, then it might be that the Pesach gets rid of the obligation of Shiva and he doesn't have to sit Shiva. So Rav Cook says, this Rav Berman, who wrote him the letter, quoted a Chasam Sofer in Yeridea in the Tshuvot, Simon Shin Mem Bet, who proved from a Ravid, and that there's also Hagos Maimonides that says it, that from Hilchos Evel in the Rambam, that you don't want Lo Yehei, the reason why we have this rule, that if they were Shogeg Mezid or they didn't have an opportunity, is Lo Yehei Chotei Niskar. We have a concept in halacha in a lot of contexts. This would be one of them. You don't want somebody who commits a sin to benefit from the sin. So if we think of Shiva as being a burden, and in halacha very often was thought of it that way, and therefore people want to get out of it, and therefore we think of letting people have less time for Shiva as a kula. So a lot of cases, if you can figure out where there's a way to say they only have to sit for, you know, 4 days instead of 5 days, whatever it is, so that we think of that as a kula in halacha. Halacha thinks that the experience of Shiva can be a burden. Some people don't experience it that way, I think. So I think some people experience it as a beneficial time. But that's the general halachic thing. So therefore, if we allowed somebody who accidentally, you know, unwittingly didn't keep Shiva, didn't realize they were supposed to keep Shiva, and therefore didn't keep it, and then we let them say, okay, so you're out of it, that would be a problem of lo yeh chotei niskar. The sinner would benefit from his or her sin. That's in English, I think the phrase for that is moral hazard. Moral hazard is where we reward in some way misdeeds. If you reward misdeeds, then people will have the incentive to do that again because they got benefit from it. And therefore, and then another possibility, they're related to each other. We're going to get into it. As Vikansu Shogei Gamkin Mekimazid, and they gave this fine, they punished a shogeg, a person who didn't realize what they were doing, didn't understand what they were, that they had done something wrong, just like amazing, just like somebody did it deliberately. So it seems like the reason, this is what Rav Kook says, the reason of Lohino Chote Niskar is because if you just told me about the question of Knas, that it's a fine, then you'd have to say, well, in which cases do we punish when we fine people, when we say you did something wrong and therefore we give you a fine? Some cases we include shogegim, we include people who did it unwittingly, in some cases we don't. So that'll be a question. So that's why the Shulchan Aruch would mention the issue of Lohi Chotei Niskar, because that'll be an example where we're always sure, or often sure. Of course, goes into the fact that we have different sugyos that go different ways, but Gemara Gittin seems to say for sure that whenever we have a situation of Lohi Chotei Niskar, that we want to make sure the sinner doesn't benefit from the sin, that we punish the shogeg also. And then Rav Kook says, and this is an important point, he's going to go on for it with it for a bit, so it's like an important piece of the tshuva, and I think perhaps when I was picking, I don't just pick these tshuva and then record them. I pick them, and then I go through them, and then I review them again before I record, and then I record them. So I think back when I was picking this tshuva, this is one of the elements of it that was interesting to me, because I think people don't always think about that. And I think when people say in English, you know, I did it accidentally, they often mean be'onis. Right? They often mean, I didn't even know what I was doing when I did it. Let's say, you know, I accidentally flipped on a light on Shabbat. So what does that mean? So sometimes it means, you know, my shoulder bumped against it as I was walking by. That's not shogeg. That's an onus. That's, I didn't realize what I was doing. That's probably mitasek rather than onus. I didn't know what I was doing. Right? Now, if I'm in a bathroom, let's say, if this is just the case that comes up for me, maybe that was a broad, bad example, but let's say I'm in the bathroom and I'm finishing and I flip the light off. That's an interesting question, because shogeg generally means I knew what I was doing, but either I didn't know it was prohibited, or I didn't realize I was in the situation was prohibited. So in Shabbos terms, let's say I don't know that it's Shabbat. So in the bathroom case where you're flipping off a light, it's probably true that at that moment you forgot that it was Shabbat. So that would be a full-fledged shogeg. But shogeg always involves knowing the action to do it. But when people say I did it accidentally, they often mean I didn't at all mean to do the action. That's a whole different category in halacha. It's either a mitasek, I'm not involved in the action, I don't realize what I'm doing, or an onus, I couldn't stop myself, right? You know, you get into a car accident. So a car accident, people say, well, you know, I couldn't turn on my brakes in time, right? Or I didn't notice the guy in time. So that's not a shogeg. We call it an accident, but it's not a shogeg. It's another thing in halacha. But a shogeg, which means somebody knows what they're doing, but they forget some halachic, or they don't realize at the time, some halachic aspect of it. They don't realize the conditions that they're in, or they don't realize that this item is, that this thing is us, meaning, you know, I eat pork. Act, what would be to eat pork bishogeg? So two possibilities. I know this is pork, but I know that pork is usur for whatever reason. I have some reason to think that pork is not usur, or this pork is not usur, right? Or I don't realize that it's pork. I think that it's white meat of chicken, and therefore I eat it. So both of those are a shogeg, but I know what I'm doing. Those cases, Rav Kook says, a shogeg is considered a chote in halacha. That's a sin. It's not a sin that's as fully culpable as doing it on purpose and knowing what you're doing and doing it anyway. But it's a sin. How does he know this? And that'll be irrelevant, therefore, to, well, when we get back to him, we're going to get back to him only in a while. When we get back to him, it's going to be relevant to our guy about whether he's going to sit shiva or not, because if he's a shogeg in the sense that he says, oh, I thought at war I didn't have to sit shiva, that'll be a shogeg, right? So if that's a shogeg, then we, if we say, shlohei chotei niskar, right, we don't want the sinner to benefit from his sin, from his decision, that will include shogegin. Because shogegin are considered chotim. How do we know this? So Gemara in Bava Kama, Lamitet Amud Aleph, talks about a knas that Chazal applied to a Baal HaKutit. The exact knas is not our issue now, but a man has a relation with a woman he's not supposed to have, and they say it's Bidit Shalohei Chotei Niskar, and they say it's because we don't want sinners to benefit from their sin. So in this case, have relations with somebody who you're not allowed to have relations with, and then, so we say, oh, that was us. You say, okay, but I enjoyed myself, and too bad, haha. So the answer is we apply a knas to that, and that knas has no distinction between a shogeg and a mezid. How do we know? Because Gemara in Ketubot Lamedalid includes it in the consideration of what's called chayvi malkot shogeg. And there are people who, we think that if they had done an action on purpose and deliberately, they would be chayav malkot, they would be liable to lashes from a court. They did it b'shogeg, then they're sinners and they have other punishments to come to them. So that shows that they're considered part of that thing. They really are chayvi malkot, they just have to be shogegin. So there the Gemara happens to mention, and this is sort of a digression, but I think it's an interesting digression that teaches us about halacha in ways that we don't always know, that it's really only because they didn't give warning to him, right? For a court, for a court to punish somebody in halacha, there have to be two witnesses, and the two witnesses not only have to testify that the person did the crime or the sin, they have to testify that they warned that person, the perpetrator ahead of time saying that is prohibited to do, just to remind us of how little we know and how much we're supposed to know, at least Rashi seems to have held that those warning witnesses not only have to tell him or tell the perpetrator what that there's a sin, they have to name the sin, and they have to provide the pasuk, the source in the Torah that's the source of that. So it becomes a big challenge to be a witness in those situations. Getting back to the Rav Kook, he says the Gemara there talks about that they didn't warn the perpetrator. That's not because we need that the person be doing it deliberately and without warning. We can't be sure they're doing it deliberately. And then if they didn't warn him, we say, if they didn't warn the perpetrator, we say, okay, the perpetrator was really doing it deliberately. We just happened not to warn him. So technically, we can't give the perpetrator the full punishment. So, no, he says, Elamish, the Dailif Durbin Malkot, Maidalo Atrube. That's just because that's what tells you that that's an easy way to say you can't give the guy Malkot. But even though the Gemara seems to refer only to the idea of people who didn't get warning from the witnesses, Rav Kook says it's obvious they don't mean that, but that a shogeg mamash would be somebody where nobody has a doubt that the person didn't realize the full ramifications of what they were doing. That person too would be chayav in this knas, would be obligated to pay this fine because it's about not letting somebody who commits a sin and they know what they're doing at the time of the sin, even if they don't realize the full ramifications of it, that's included in these knesot, in these fines. The whole point of the Gemara is just to point out that the point of hatra'ah is to make sure we know who's a shogeg and who's a mezid, so we can know who to punish which ways. But it doesn't mean that a shogeg is different. It doesn't mean that other shogegim are not shogegim. So that means that anybody who doesn't get a hatra'ah from witnesses is bechizkat shogeg. We're allowed to assume that they're a shogeg, but a shogeg is still chayav in kenas, because the kenas is for anybody who didn't have hatra'ah, and we include them in that. And another point is, Rav Yochanan in Ketubot, Lamed Amedet, says that a kenas is really mostly about a shogeg, and it's mostly about those people, or it's only for those people who didn't get hatra'ah. And we say, lo yehei chotei niskar, we don't want somebody who commits a sin getting a reward for doing that sin. So we see that includes and applies to a shogeg as well, somebody who doesn't do it with full awareness of what they're doing. So that helps the chasam sofer that we spoke about before, that it's only a shogeg that you need a drora to knasa, that you'd say lo yehei chotei niskar, but in ones, right, if you have the person that's completely out of their control, so that's the whole thing. For those people don't have the name of a chotei. Then Rav Kook points out that in fact, while we in English would say that sinner mostly applies to those who know what they're doing and are intent on doing it, in halacha, the word chote is only one of several terms for sinner. And in fact, that term of chote seems actually to apply mostly to a shogeg. Why does he think that? So the Gemara Yomer Lamed Vav Bet, we all sort of know it because we say some of it in our liturgy. We say in Rosh Hashanah Kippur time, in Slichot, and then in Yom Kippur, when we want to confess our sins, we say either aviti, chatati, pashati, chatati, aviti, pashati. And in the discussion there in Yom Lamed Vav Amid Bet, it becomes clear that the word chatati means a shogeg. The Gemara there is talking about the order in which you say it. Some hold we say aviti, chatati, pashati, some say chatati, aviti, but whatever the order is that you say it, it's clear in the Gemara that chatati means a shogeg, doesn't fully realize the ramifications of what they're doing. Aviti means they know, I think aviti means they know what they're doing, and they're doing it on purpose, but only because they're interested in the sin, they are weak and lured and too tempted by the sin. And pashati would be that they do it on purpose, lahakis, meaning there's an element of it they want to just violate because they like violating the sin, not because they're overwhelmingly interested in what it is that they have. So that would seem to, all this is a way of him to say, in the case of our guy at war, or if he was an ones, really, then we're going to treat him one way. If it was a shogeg, then he's going to treat him as a chote, and then he'll probably be included in the requirement to make up for the shiva that didn't sit. Now, that assumption that there's this difference, though, runs afoul of another halacha, of chametz shavar alav pesach. When it comes to chametz shavar alav pesach, if a Jew owned chametz over the course of Pesach, there we say that it doesn't matter what led to that Jew owning that chametz over Pesach, even if it was be'ones, even if there was nothing he could have done about it, that still qualifies for the fact that chametz can no longer be used. It's chametz shavar alav pesach, and there's this fine, there's this knas, that it becomes completely unusable and you know not allowed to get any benefit from it. So Rav Kook recognizes that, but he says that is not a general principle in halacha, that we punish onsim in that way, that we punish people who acted against their will in that way. We don't, and therefore we can't apply that anywhere else. It's just a special case of chametz shavar alav pesach, about chametz and pesach and the seriousness of that led to that halacha, but that's not a general perspective in halacha, general perspective of halacha, is that onsim, the people who really couldn't avoid it, they are completely free of any culpability, any liability, any status as sinner. And really, it seems like the Rambam held that they're not even considered part of having violated the prohibition. Oh, I'm sorry. The Rambam includes it as a special prohibition in the Torah that it's prohibited to punish somebody who is anus. If you look at the Sefer Mitzvot, according to the Rambam, in the prohibition number, Reish Tzadi Dalet 294, he says the Torah prohibits us from punishing those who are anus, ala chait, who were coerced, who couldn't have avoided a chait. And that's from the Pasuk of L'na'ara lo te'aseh davar. When the Torah talks about rape, so it talks about the possibility of a woman that it happened within a village, within a town, and there the Torah seems to assume that it's in a way where she could have found people to help her, and if she didn't, we assume therefore she was a willing partner, and that would be a problem because she was a willing partner. But the way the Torah says it is outside of town, outside of a city, when she's just out there in the middle of nowhere, however she got there, if somebody then rapes her, then we say, no, you don't punish her at all because it was against your will. Obviously, if you could show that it was against your will and it was, and nothing she could have done about it within the city, that would also be true. But the Rambam takes from there not only that particular halacha when it comes to rape situation, but the Rambam learns from there a general prohibition that we do not punish those who were anus, those who were unable to avoid whatever happened to them. And the Gemara, and the Gemara says also ones rechamana patri, a general principle, the Torah is poter, that the Torah exempted completely from any liability an anus, somebody who was unable to avoid doing something, and they quote this pasuk as well. And that's true. It's all discussion of the Rav Kook pointing. The Rambam says it about about capital crimes, but Rav Kook says the only reason why we say it by capital crimes is because you might have thought that in capital crimes are so serious that even if you do it against your will, there's nothing you could have done to avoid it, we still would think of you as a sinner and you have to be punished in some way. But all the more so that about lesser sins, that if it was done by onus, that the person who did it by onus, if it's really by onus, they didn't have any ability to avoid it, that there is no culpability attached to that. Now, it is true that there are three sins that we say a person is supposed to be killed rather than transgress: murder and worshiping other gods than Kadosh Baruch Hu, other powers than Hashem, and certain forms of sexual immorality, sexual impropriety. In those cases, though, we say that if you do it, even if it's against your will, you are desecrating the Shem Hashem, but that doesn't mean that we're allowed to punish such a person, because we don't punish them for that sin because they are an onus. Meaning, even there, the status of an onus, the status of it happening against their will, has important relevance to the situation. It is true that there the Torah said that if you're an onus, in the sense of somebody saying to you, if the coercion is such that, meaning, if somebody takes the person and force them to do it, right? They take your hand, they force a gun into your hand, and then they force you to pull the trigger. That's an onus in the sense that we can't imagine there's any culpability whatsoever, because there's no way you could resist it. Unless you could have struggled so hard, they would have had to kill you. But let's suppose they were able to literally force you to do it. That's not what we're talking about. But there are cases where we consider somebody an onus, where in theoretically, physically, they could have done something different. Nonetheless, because they're an onus, they're those halakhot, those mitzvot, those sins, they're not allowed to take advantage of it and transgress, even though there's an onus, but nonetheless, we also don't give them the full punishment. Now it comes back to our case, and he says, but in our case, we have to look into this question, was he really an onus? Meaning, if he was really, you know, manning the cannon 24 hours a day for 6 days or whatever it was, and therefore he couldn't have sat Shiva in that situation until Pesach came, so that would be one kind of situation. That would be really an onus. You have to look at it as really an onus such that, and here's the standard, he couldn't have fulfilled any of the Dinei Avelus, even for a short period of time. He couldn't have taken off his leather shoes and gone barefoot for a little bit, or sat on the ground for a little bit, and things like that. So it would seem like most people could have that opportunity, but maybe in the rush of battle, the rush of war, he literally could not have done it, and then he would qualify as an onus, and then there would be no thought to apply to him this knas and making him sit a full shiva. Then Rav Kook says, but even if it were true that he could have done those other things and he didn't, and therefore theoretically he'd say he's a shogeg, he did cry, and he did talk about his father and Mekonin, and in some sense eulogized him or complained or expressed his sadness at his father's passing to his friends, you can say that maybe that counts as one of the Dinei Avelut, as one of the laws of Avelut that he has observed, and therefore it would count, maybe. Why would I think that? Because there's a halacha in the Gemara, the first 3 days are for crying, and then the 7 days are for hesped, for talking about the person who passed away. So therefore, maybe you could say that they count as halachos avelus. Usually we think of the halachos avelus, laws of avelus, of sitting on the floor, not washing, having torn kriya, wearing your torn clothing, not washing, not anointing oneself in oil, and not wearing leather shoes, and not having, you know, marital relations between a husband and wife. So you might have thought that was the whole list. If he didn't do any of those things, he hasn't fulfilled Avelut. Also, if Cook points out, well, except that the Gemara does say the first 3 days are for crying, the 7 days are for Hesped. If he did one of those two things, even if he did nothing else, maybe that would be included in the obligation of Avelut. And since it would be included in the obligation of Avelut, his having done one of those things means he didn't completely ignore the Avelut, and therefore this Knas of he has to sit a full Shiva wouldn't apply. Except that, if you look at the Gemara in Moed Katan, Chaf Zayin Amid Bet, when it says 3 days are for crying and 7 days are for Hesped, it sounds like those aren't actual obligations. It sounds like those are the limits. It's telling you, don't try hard not to cry after 3 days. Try hard not to be saying full eulogies after 7 days, because within the context of Avilut, there's this whole problem of we don't want to seem like we're more compassionate than Hashem, and Hashem felt the person had to pass away, and we feel like, no, we still need to talk about the person. We still need to cry on this person. So Halacha tries to guide us in allowing us time to mourn, and then telling us when it's time to move on. So you might have thought that Gemara in Moed Katan, if you read it simply, it seems like it's telling you the time beyond which, I think it's the terminus ad quo, something in Latin fancy you could say, that's the time beyond which you shouldn't be doing these things. But nonetheless, from the fact that they tell you beyond these things, you shouldn't be doing these things, this seems to be part of it. And Rav Kook says it seems to be like ironing clothing or taking haircuts, which are part of the mitzvah of shloshim. So if somebody came to me and said, I never kept shloshim, do I have to keep shloshim again? But they said, but I didn't take a haircut that whole time, or I didn't wash my clothing that whole time. That would count as the observances of shloshim, and therefore they would have observed it in some sense. So here too, you could say the fact that he spoke about his father and he cried about his father would count for Shlosha v'shiva, for 3 days, for 7 days, and therefore he wouldn't have to go back and do it again. And the man who had written him this, Rav Berman, had quoted some sources from the Stechemet, who had said exactly that. Maybe crying and talking about the person who passed away qualifies as having fulfilled the avilut, which of course has important ramifications for us, because you might have people who don't know halacha very well, and then when they learn about halacha, and they realize they never mourned in the formal way, although today most people mourn in the formal way at least a little bit, even Jews who are sadly very far from observance, they mourn at least a little bit in the formal way, but let's say they never did, but they say, but I spent, you know, a lot of time crying about it, the person who passed away, or talking to friends about it, and how sad I was about it, that might qualify as a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Avilut to some extent, at least to enough an extent, they don't have to go back and do it again. And enough of a fulfillment that if a regular came along, if a holiday comes along, that would be enough to stop it, right? So let's say the person went to the funeral, for whatever reason, they never sat Shiva, and they spent a few, and they never had a formal Shiva of any of the kinds of halachas that we think of it, that we connect to Shiva, but they did talk about it, and they did cry about it, and then it became a holiday, and then they come to ask the question, they realize they never had a Shiva, so there are those who hold, that's what Cook's saying, there are according to who held, that no, that's good enough for them to not have to go back, because they will have fulfilled some of the mitzvot of Eilut, and therefore the regel can stop the obligation. And he says we should try to find the kulos here, even though there are some Rishonim, there's a Ravid, there's a Hagolos Maimonios, there's a Ramban, who had one opinion, or in the Ramban, at least one opinion had it, that we should try, that we should make the person go back and do it. We should rule that even a shogeg has to go back, we should be a machmir, make them go back and do a full Shiva. But the simple reading of the Rambam and the Rach seems to be that it's not a matter of fulfilling it completely, it's the obligation, that if the person was already obligated in Shiva before a holiday, then the holiday stops it, and therefore that would mean that there would be room for more of a kula. He gives a proof of that, one example of a proof. The proofs aren't so exciting to me. One of the other proofs is the Rambam writes a kovert mekto shachat of their regal. Somebody who buries a relative a short time before the holiday comes. It doesn't mention, now, we have the Shulchan Aruch that says you're supposed to fulfill it. The Shulchan Aruch does follow the opinion of the Ravid and the Ramban and the Hagolos Maimonios, but which who say that you have to actually have observed Avelut before the regal, before the holiday, in order for it to suspend Avelut. But since the Ram has that language, it's enough of a room to help us out and to think that since we have other ideas as well, that maybe this guy doesn't have to go back and do Avelos, because we can think maybe he was an onus, he didn't really have the ability to, and if he did, maybe he did some of it, and all these things are helping us come to a conclusion that he doesn't have to go back and sit a full Shiva. In addition to that, as well, that since he didn't know there was halacha until after 30 days of the person having passed away, maybe that's enough, even though he had heard about the death, but he didn't hear that he was obligated in anything, he didn't know he was obligated in anything, until after 30 days after that, maybe that qualifies Shmuel Rechoka. Meaning, we usually think of Shmuel Rechoka Yehud as being Yehud after the person passed away, more than 3 days after the person passed away. Now we're talking about the fact that you hear the fact the person passed away within 30 days, but the person who hears it doesn't realize there's an obligation of Shiva at all, however that happens, for more than 30 days. This would be an example of it, because they think, I'm at war, and then they think, and there was a holiday, and they think all this got them out of it. They don't realize till after 30 days, after the person passed away, that no, that in fact they were obligated. Maybe that's good enough to say it's a Shmuel Rechokah. In case of Shmuel Rechokah, they just sit on the ground for like 10 minutes and take off their shoes and they're fine. Why would Rav Kook think that? He says, I have an example. In the Darim Pezayin Amid Bet, so if a person says, the halacha is that if a woman takes certain kinds of oaths that will affect her marital relationship with her husband, it will make strains or tensions in the marriage, the husband has the right to be mayfair that neder. He can say, I don't want it to be a neder, and then it doesn't count as a neder, and it goes away. So the mission in the Dharma Pezayin Bet says that the husband, and he has to do it, though, I'm sorry, he has to do it within the first day of hearing that she made the neder. Until he hears about it, he couldn't possibly be mayfair, he never knew about it. But once he hears about it, he has that day to be mayfair the neder, to say that the neder is null and void. So what if he hears, doesn't say anything, we think that means that he no longer has the power to nullify the nether, then it turns out he never knew that there was such a right, a power of the husband's to be made for the nether. He says, of course I don't want to have this nether, and of course I would have made for it. So the answer is, we hold that it's the day of him knowing that he has this power, knowing that there's this halacha, knowing that there's this din. So here too, it could be, he says, that we don't count it as the day of hearing until he hears of the obligation, and therefore we think there's an obligation in Shiva until he hears in such a way that he knows there's an obligation, and that would make it a Shmua Rechoka. So he says you have to think about all these situations. You have to look carefully into the exact circumstances that happened, when he heard about it, when he didn't hear about it. If it looks to you like he really was anonymous, like he really couldn't have avoided it, and he didn't keep it for valid reasons, he thinks there's room. These are all the reasons he has to think there's room to say this bear would not have to have Shiva. So we not have to sit Shiva again. So we have the case itself, whether or not a particular soldier who heard about his father's passing while he was in the army and while he was in battle, basically, does he have to go back and do it again? But broader than that, we have the discussion of what counts as a shogeg, what counts as an ones, and that is Rav Kook teaching us halachos on the 7th of Iyar. Have a great day.